Accession number 29163, Real 3.
John Chariot, Reel 3. We're still talking about Thamesford, and I wanted to ask you about the ground crew and the relationship between the crews and the ground crew.
Well, that was always very good, we found. The skippers have had most to do with that, of course, although we were all concerned, and they were always very interested in anything they could pick up about your family. That's what I found. They wanted to know all about you, where you lived, and this sort of thing, because they knew they were not allowed to ask too many questions about where we'd been. But they would know, for instance, how much fuel had been used, and if you came back, they would say, oh, it's a long trip, go far, you know, this sort of thing. They were very interested, and we always found them. They were so reliable, and they would do anything at all to make sure that it wouldn't be their fault that the aircraft didn't return. It would be for some other reason that you didn't return, not to do with anything to do with the engines. So yes, I would say it was all a very excellent man.
Would they work on a specific aircraft?
Yes, you had the same crew as far as possible, yes. They worked on your aircraft, yes. And they didn't do what Bomber Command used to do, and they used to put on, you know, a symbol of some sort on the aircraft as to how many trips, you know, what number of trips you'd done, but we didn't have any of that. You know, because presumably there was no point of advertising the fact that we were a squadron doing something different.
Were the markings in any way different on the aircraft? Were they painted differently?
No, just the same. Mm-hmm. Just the same.
Also, we talked earlier about the Whitley and the modifications that were made to the Whitley. And of course, you moved on to the Halifax.
The Halifax was the same, yes. Now, in the Halifax, of course, we carried one extra crew. We had an engineer whose job was to do that, look after the engine side for the skipper. And he was also, he would do other jobs as well. He would help with the dispatcher. We had maybe four bodies to go out. And he was always on hand to assist the skipper. He would sit in the second pilot's seat on takeoff and hold the throttles open. Or if he was doing something else by changing fuel tanks, I would do it. But that wasn't until we had Squadron Leader Griffiths. Flight Sergeant Freelander, we were still on Whitleys then. And that was the one where we had such success as a crew. Out of 9 trips, as I say, 7 of them were successful, which was a very high percentage in those days. But then the whole thing fell apart because I had to go on a court-martial up in Kinloss, which was next door to Lossiemouth, right in the north of Scotland, where Sergeant Wilde had been sent to be a witness on a court-martial that was held in Canberra. And I was going to be as a character witness. And I said to the adjutant down at Thamesford, what am I supposed to do? And he said, well, this person wants you to come up and say that he's a good chap, virtually. So off I went and did just that. So that night, Flight Sergeant and his crew had another navigator from the squadron, and they didn't return. And when I got back, I was quite devastated, because we'd got to know each other so well in the 3 months, 2.5 to 3 months we'd known each other, and we knew that we were doing a good job and working well together. And just because I wasn't there, I'm not saying it would have been any different, because I don't know, never did hear how it happened, except that they were shot at and the aircraft came down and nobody was able to get out. Because if they were at 500 feet or less, then they wouldn't be able to get out, of course. There'd be no time, because not like with Joe's, who are on a static parachute, you would have to get out. Well, you had to clip your parachute on first and then jump out and then pull the cord, by which time you must have been very near the ground from that height. So that was very sad. And there I was again, for the third time, without a crew, stuck at Thamesford.
And was that stage, was it then that... actually, first of all, I noticed from your from the summary of operations that you showed me before, there was about 6 months when you weren't on operations.
Yeah.
Is that correct? What was?
Well, this is the period. Well, I was, but not with a crew. I was doing odd things with. If I look at my log book, Flight Sergeant, that was about September. The end of September was my last trip with them. And then I didn't start doing anything else until the 9th of February. And I was hanging about the crew room, really, doing odd jobs for the leader of the navigation section, who was a squadron leader, helping planning routes for new crews and that sort of thing, until eventually they said, well, there are lots of more crews coming. I think the squadron expanded probably around about this time. This was the beginning of 43, and they had a lot more Halifaxes come, a lot more crews, more people going off sick for various reasons, and so I got the jobs of going on as mostly as a second navigator, really, doing map reading, because I found that I could do this job very well and I liked to do it. And so the CEO said, well, you know, go out on a few trips. So that's what I did, and I did five there. One of them was including, of course, this one on the 16th of February 1943, the Operation Gunnerside. And that was, you know, I was down in the logbook, I see a second pilot. And so that's what it must have been. And but actually I was in the nose of the aircraft the whole time, the whole journey, which was 8 hours, 25 minutes from Thamesford to back. And that was with a squadron leader Gibson, not the famous Guy Gibson, but another Gibson. And unfortunately, two trips after that, he was lost over Czechoslovakia. So I was really quite lucky on more than one occasion.
And can you tell me about the Gunnerside
yeah.
trip?
Well, it was great. The first thing was to see these six chaps arrive at the aircraft. Well, no, we really did see them, because they were huge. And they were all carrying a tremendous amount of equipment, which they dumped, of course, in the aircraft. They didn't come in a car. They came in a big lorry. And then we loaded up all the ground crew, loaded up all their containers. I think there they had probably the maximum, which was 12. And the dispatcher was told that there was going to be six of them, and they were big chaps. Watch their heads. I remember him saying, I was told to watch their heads as they go out. Anyway, we set off, and it was a lovely night, and we had the station navigation officer came as the navigator, and as I say, I was up in the nose all the time, and we went across the North Sea. We made a very good landing where we wanted to, just near Stavanger, and then off to where the dropping site was to be. And that was where it got difficult. Now, there had been many trips to try and land these other six. Four of them, as we were talking about, had been there since the previous October. And it was now February. And these six, their code name was Grouse. They had been up there living on this frozen ground, lake, really. They were near a lake, and that was our dropping point, supposed to be near a lake. Well, I think we got fairly near it. We were finding it very difficult. Everybody was looking out. The rear gunner was a great help. At one time he said, you know, you're talking about fluffy clouds. I'm not sure, he said. I think these are the tops of some mountains, not fluffy clouds you're going over. So it was as bad as that. Anyway, it had been agreed with Runnenberg before we started and Gibson that they would do a blind drop, because it was essential now that they got there and destroyed this heavy water plant. So we circled around, then Johan said, well, this is very close. I can recognise certain features. Go around again and we'll do the drop. And we'll go first and then go around again and send the containers down. So they all went quite happily. And the rear gunner always reported all parachutes opened, which was useful to know. And then we round again and we dropped the containers. But it was not the correct spot, as I found out now 50 years later when I met him at Imperial War Museum. I think they were 30 kilometres away. But so they got in touch and the others moved up and found them. So they all joined up, and I think it was, what, 9 nights later that the raid took place.
Had you any idea at the time what they were going to do?
No, none at all. No, none at all. Except that we knew it was important, because we had been told this was the last chance of a moon in February, and that would mean another month would go by. And the people who knew at the War Office said that that could be too late. But, I mean, we didn't know that until afterwards. We didn't know that at the time. And then we just, you know, you watch these chaps go down and you turn around and go back to Thamesford. And I often thought about them, well, what are they going to do? I hopefully am going to get back to base, you know, and have a warm bed and something to eat. And what are they going to do? And then it isn't until afterwards that you realise what they did suffer.
When did you hear about what they'd done? There was some press coverage, I think, a tiny bit of it.
Yes. I didn't hear anything about it at all until after I'd left the squadron. Then I don't quite know how I heard. But, I mean, the details were picked up, as I say, at the Imperial War Museum lecture. Mm. That was a great night, it really was. And so extraordinary to see him again, you know. And we couldn't stop talking. It was quite funny. Did you see a picture as you came in? Yeah. Standing there in Imperial War Museum, you know, as though nobody else was around.
What did you talk about? Did you talk about
the flight? About the whole thing, yes. I was very anxious to know how far out we were, because I'd read books that said that they were not dropped where they should be. Well, when we did know that, we were pretty certain of it. And he said, oh, well, it didn't really matter. We did get in radio touch with the Grouse team fairly quickly, and we just skied towards them, and then they helped us. They skied to us, and they helped us deal with the containers and all the equipment we wanted. And then they must have had a plan already done, of course, because I think, as I say, it was only about 4 nights, 8 or 9 nights, and then they carried out the raid. And of course, when he explained about this raid at the Imperial War Museum, it's amazing how they managed to do it. No shots were fired. Extraordinary. Mind you, they did have somebody on the inside, a watchman, who let them in, and then he told them to bash him about a bit and tie him up, which they did. And there were never any reprisals. So he said,
when he was giving the talk in the museum, what was the reception? Like we mentioned it, you mentioned it earlier on.
Actually. Yeah, well, it was absolutely amazing. They asked for questions, or several questions being asked, and this sort of thing. And I mean, Mark Seaman had surprised him. He hadn't told Johan that the navigator of the aircraft would be at this lecture, for one thing, you see. which I thought was a bit mean at the time. And so they, a lot of them had seen me talking to him. Hodges was there, and group captain, not his name, Batchelor. And you see, at the time, I was then the warrant officer, so was not known in the officers' mess at all. And as I say, the rest of the crew had all been killed 2 weeks later on another trip to Czechoslovakia. So I was the only actual person alive who'd been on this and this aircraft. Quite amazing, yes.
Absolutely.
Again, just to drop back again, just to the general question.
The Czechs.
Oh, yeah, there was the Czechs. There was also... How did the Halifax compare to the Whitley as well?
Halifax was vastly different, yes. You could go a bit faster, for one thing, and it was a much bigger aircraft to move about it. I mean, the Whitley, it was really cramped. To get to the nose was not easy, much easier in the Halifax. You just has to drop down underneath a pilot's cabin and you were in the nose sort of thing, not crawl about on your hands and knees. And you felt much safer. And we did have an upper turret where you could take, as I say, Astro shots, but no one ever used it, not at that height. There was no point. And we didn't have a gunner up there, which is the point of the turret. We just had one rear gunner. And there was a couple of guns in the front which I could use if necessary when I was down there, but I only ever used them once.
What was that occasion?
Coming back from Holland, and we'd been on this last trip but three of mine where we dropped this Lieutenant Colonel, who's a friend of Prince Bernard's, when they were having all this trouble with the Germans had really broken the codes of, I think it was 50, 60 pianists, you know, who had been dropped, and they'd got their codes, and no one had realised it in London. And so ever so many aircraft, well, we reckon that 12 aircraft from 138 were lost, which was about 83 crew, for careless mistake back in London. Not finding out that they had been sending warnings that they had been captured, but no one picked it up. And MRD Foote is very strong about this in his book that he wrote about SOE. He says it was, you know, a very poor thing. And all of them, bar three, were shot in the end, before the end of the war. All these agents, most of them Dutch. Some English as well, I gather.
Now, you made several drops, of course, to these to the Dutch. Were you aware, or clearly weren't aware at the time, of the sort of risks you were taking?
No, it wasn't until, as we were saying at the interval, talking about this film that was being made by the BBC, that this all came out. And it was this chap, Chris Riley, who was the producer of the film, who'd got hold of, well, I suppose anybody could have got hold of it by then, exactly what was going on. And the Germans were so well organised that they knew when an aircraft was coming to Holland, they knew where it was going to be, but in order not to spoil things for themselves, they didn't shoot every aircraft down as it got over the dropping point. They just decided on the odd one. And then you could carry on dropping, and it wasn't, as I say, until I think it was 18 months that someone really realised that there was, you know, something going wrong. And that was when we dropped this Lieutenant Colonel, who was seen off by Prince Bernard. And he was, presumably, did something about finding out exactly what was going on, and then all trips to Holland were stopped for I don't know how many months, quite a few. But by that time, I'd left the squadron by, you know, some time.
And it was returning from one of these drops that you...
Yes. When we got to this particular night, I mean, it's only a short trip, We always used to go in at the north end of Holland and come down the Zuider Zee, and you could, you know, go at sea level there and jump over the dikes halfway down, three quarters of the way down, and we were dropping just right at the bottom of the Zuider Zee on the south side of it, and we had a party waiting for us. I mean, we knew that there would be lights, but we also had this important gentleman with us. We did learn that before he came on board, because Griff was a skipper then. Griff had recognised Prince Bernard and said, "Go," he said, "you have to watch out here." We got to the dropping place and I could see the lights. It was such a lovely night, really clear. And I could see the lights from a long way down out in the water, while we were over the water. And I said to Griff, "Look, I can see the lights." I said, "They've got them alight already." And I said, "I think I'm right on track. You're at the right height. We'll just go over and drop straight away." So we went over the lights, I pressed the buttons, and the containers went down. And we then speeded away as fast as we could, which was the normal procedure. As I'd said before, wheels came up, flaps came up, and you got away as fast as you could. So then we said to Lily Joe, "Right, now we find a spot for you." And he said, "Well, I don't want to be too far away from the drop." Anyway, we circled around a bit, and Griff saw a field, and I agreed with him, it looked suitable. And so we dropped him off there, about probably 20-25 kilometres from where we dropped the containers. And then, as I say, at this reunion, it was the reunion when they found out they were doing this film, they told us that that particular light, obviously, it was Squadron Leader Griffith's crew that they were waiting for. But because we'd gone straight over and not diddled about, they weren't prepared. They were prepared for the aircraft to circle so they could, you know, get a good aim, I suppose. And coming home, I don't know, Griff must have had a premonition anyway, because normally after going to Holland, we would cut out as quickly as we could to the North Sea, close to Amsterdam. But he said, "No," he said, "I fancy going the way we came in." So I said, "All right." And we went back the way we came in between the two islands, Texel and Vierland, I think the other one was called. And on the way there, we saw two fighters going across our path. And Gus said, "I think we've done the wise thing. There are two fighters out there." And that was when we saw a fishing boat, a Dutch one, and it started firing at us. That was the only... Then I said, "Can I fire my guns?" You see? And Griff said, "Yes." So I fired a few shots, and then the rear gunner, of course, he'd got a battery of four. I only had two Vickers in the front turret, and didn't do anything at all. I don't think he did anyway. We were just going fast to get away then. And then it was when we found all this out, as I say, afterwards, when they were making this film, it all came to light. And then again, realised how lucky we'd been.
And that, just to double check, that particular operation was in June 43, I think.
Yeah, it was. June 43. Now, what was the date? 16th of June, I think. Yeah, no, 10th. Yes, we had the operation. Oh, this is the, Operation Turnip 11 and Marrow 38. The code name of the Baron, when I met him at another reunion, he was Baron Louis Dalluy de Coroville or something. We never did learn. He said, "Oh, don't worry about that." He said, "Just call me Louis." And his wife was there, and this amused my wife. We were chatting away before we sat down to dinner, and he said to me, "Why did you drop me in a field of cows?" So I said, "Well, that seemed fairly safe. It's better than the Germans, wasn't it?" And his wife agreed. She said, "Yes." No, they were a lovely couple. He was, I think I mentioned this before to you when you phoned. He was a great sailor, and he asked where we lived, and I said, oh, on the south coast near Hastings. He said, you will know my landmark. So I said, yes, what's that? He said, well, you have a church on the hill called Fairlight Church. And he said, well, I'm out in the channel, that is my marker to find out where I was, where I am, and I can take a bearing on it. That was quite interesting too. So those are the two really, I suppose, interesting operations which I was, I suppose, lucky enough to be on, really, by chance.
There was another one there were many, of course, but there was one in May 1943.
Yeah.
When you were badly shot up.
Oh, yes. Yeah. That was in France, wasn't it, somewhere? That's again where having this Terry as the rear gunner, he'd done one tour with Bomber Command already, so he was very experienced. He took a commission, and then as Griff was picking his crew, he found that this chap, he was free as well, he hadn't got a crew at the time, so he said, join us, and he did. And then we had a wireless operator, Peters, who's a very good bloke, and Jack Marsh, our engineer. Now, the dispatchers were never part of a crew as such, because they were not always needed unless you were dropping bodies. So you would sort of say, well, so-and-so is free, come with us tonight. And that was, so you didn't have a regular dispatcher. But it was in France, and they had these trains which were usually carrying troops, probably. But you couldn't always tell that on the back they had a gun, a flat gun. And this night we didn't pick it up, and they started firing. But Terry, from the rear turret, was so quick that he knocked it out before much damage had been done, until we heard the dispatcher screaming over the intercom, all the four Joes are hit, and the whole of the aircraft is riddled with holes. So Griff said, right, we're obviously going back. And he said, I want to come down and see. Now, this was where he'd taught us to take over someone else's job. Jack Marshall, the engineer, had learned some Morse code. And he could fire, of course, and so could I, use the guns. And he'd taught me to fly the Halifax straight and level. I mean, no way, as he said. If anything happens to me, he said, you can get them back to the south coast, and you tell them to jump, turn the aircraft round, set George on, jump out yourself, and let the aircraft go back to France. So, I mean, he was such a nice chap, and so practical on things. And he really was a great skipper. So I said, right, I'll drive across the channel. So when we got to the middle of the channel, he said, right, I'm coming back. And he said, oh, yeah, it is a mess here. When we got to Thamesford, he asked for the blood wagon to stand by. And they got four injured people on board, and these Joes were all ripped away to a hospital. And then some poor ground staff was sent in to clean up the inside of the aircraft, because I didn't see it, actually. There were lots of hypo syringes, morphine syringes about the place. And this chap went in and he found a piece of ear. And obviously come from one of these Joes. And they iced it, put it in ice, and took it to the hospital where they'd been taken. And it was stitched on, we're told, successfully. So Griff said, after. That's when I saw him afterwards, that this had happened. So that was another bit of excitement where, as I say, the skills of your rear gunner is very important.